came in today with my pouch
and opened it up and discovered I had all my cables and everything, and I'd left the actual laptop at home. So this is our lab's backup. This is an iBook G4 from early 2000s, and it's almost 15 years old. It shouldn't be alive at all, but it was retired from our lab, but we kept it around just in case we might need a backup machine. So we've got to get this level. That's roughly low. Maybe if I go like that. Okay. It's actually working. Not have believed it. Okay. And, yeah, it should be okay. So, what I want to do today, I told you in the email, is skim rather lightly over the material for a lot of the rest of the quarter so that you get it early enough that you can start thinking about, you know, what you want to do in your projects instead of waiting till the last minute when we finally give you the methods for doing things. I discovered a projection I had that I recycled into the one for this lecture that covers all that material. So, with that, and at the very end, I hope we'll have a simulation exercise, and I've given you the routine which simulates a population getting genetic, making random changes by random genetic drift and also being attracted to an adaptive peak, which itself is wandering. So we'll get into this. What we're going to do is to, let's see, there we go. We're looking for we're trying to figure out how to approximate the change of quantitative characters, because coordinates of landmarks are quantitative characters. And we'll see from Fred, you'll begin to get the machinery for removing extraneous location and rotation effects. And let me just outline quickly the material we'll cover. And so I'm going to give you a quick skim over all this, and then now I'm doing the outline of the quick skim. And it will be addressing the issue of approximating genetic drift of an individual gene frequency. And then approximating the change of a quantitative character using that. And then asking, what about mutation? And how much variation is maintained if you just have mutation bringing in changes of a quantitative character and genetic drift homogenizing the population? Mutation versus drift. And then change of the quantitative character given that. And then we'll start. Okay, so that's all mutation and drift affecting your quantitative character. And then we'll look at optimum selection and what that does. And including movement of the selective peak. And then I'll put it together as two sources of change in quantitative characters, genetic drift, genetic covariance, two sources of the covariance of changes in a lineage, genetic covariance and selective covariance, which is something you almost never hear about, but I've been campaigning for some time to get people to talk about it. And then trees with Brownian motion, and finally contrast methods. So there's a lot of stuff for analyzing data from such trees. And then there's even some additional material in the projection, but what I'll do is I'll probably run out of time before I get to that. Okay, so I've mentioned just now many of these issues, genetic drift of alleles, new alleles introduced by mutation. What happens when selection varies due to effect? Selection is tugs at the gene frequencies at each locus separately, or when it changes the whole phenotype by selecting on that phenotype. Okay. Well, I won't really go over this screen except to say for genetic drift of a single gene frequency with two alleles in the population, to what extent can we solve things like transition probabilities? Namely, what's the probability that if this is a horizontal axis of gene frequency, you go from here to there in that amount of time? That's a transition probability, and it's something you need to know. Well, the short answer is you can't solve the exact Wright-Fisher models. You can do it numerically by powering them up and get an idea what it looks like. There's diffusion approximations. They have solutions, but the solutions are so complicated that when you try to use them, they're essentially unusable. They involve infinite series of Gegenbauer polynomials. And that's for two alleles. So there's a very simple approximation that was made, and it was made in the mid-1960s by Luca Cavalli-Sforza and Anthony Edwards, who were working together in the University of Pavia in Italy, where Cavalli-Sforza, gone through R.A. Fisher's lab in Cambridge University, and then Cavalli-Sforza had gone back to a position in Pavia, and Edwards had come to work as a sort of postdoc with him. This is not... I knew something wouldn't work. So Anthony was working as a postdoc, and they were trying to figure out, they were looking to make trees of gene frequencies connecting populations that had their gene frequencies of things like blood groups taken in valleys in northern Italy. And basically what they came down to was to say, well, it's true that the variance of gene frequency from generation to generation is given by a binomial sampling variance, because each generation, 2n copies are in effect chosen with replacement, from the previous generation. That gives you that the variance depends on frequency. It's highest in intermediate gene frequencies and falls away in a parabola. So they said, well, maybe we can't, that gives you all these problems with that I mentioned on the previous panel. We can't really do that. What should we do? And they said, in effect, if you're somewhere on the scale, locally, the variance is roughly constant because P doesn't change very much. Let's just take a process whose variance doesn't change and say it's a local approximation to what's happening. And that's Brownian motion, basically. Or it's a random walk in discrete time, and in continuous time, it's Brownian motion. So, how good an approximation is it? Well, here we see, starting in a population of size 50, so a smallish population, there are 101 different possible gene frequencies. Remember, these are diploids, so two copies of allele per individual. So there's 100 copies. So you can have anywhere from 0 to 100 copies of the allele. If you start at a gene frequency of 50%, and you go forward 10 generations, and I power up the proper matrices, I get the black bars here as the exact distribution of outcomes after 10 generations. If I use the Brownian motion approximation, that's the purple circles. I take it's a normal distribution, except we folded it, we piled it up in the end classes. And it looks pretty similar, not perfect. got a little too much stuff in the middle and a little not quite enough stuff, medium out, and then a little bit of an excess out in the tails.
What is the excess in the tails? Is there a reason for that? Or?
Yeah, the reason is that the exact process isn't a random, isn't a normal normally distributed random walk. Mm-hmm. It has to pile up in the entails here. Let's see. Purple is the Brownian. Oh, I see. The Brownian approximation sticks out beyond where the gene frequencies could go and gets folded up. That's one of the reasons. But exactly rationalizing all this, I'm not awake enough right now to do. But it can, you know, you could be. Here is what happens after 50 generations. And it's not so great. The distribution is actually fairly flat across the middle, the true distribution, and the approximation, well, it's almost flat, but not quite. And when you pile it up in the tails, it piles up a little too much. So it's not perfect. Here is, if you start with an asymmetrical case with 0.1 gene frequency, true gene, initial gene frequency right here, the black bars show the true distribution, including this black bar at the end, and then the purple, the brown, the normally distributed, this thing is actually a normal distribution, you know, collected in bins, including collecting all the extreme stuff in this first bin. And you can see, not so great. So better in the middle of the distribution, and better for short periods of time than for long periods of time, when basically the gene frequencies have a chance to spread out to regions in which they will not have the same variants. But we're going to go ahead and use it. Yeah. Please be aggressive about the question.
Does the approximation improve if the population size increases?
It does in the sense that for a given number of generations, mm-hmm. you will go less far out if you have larger population. Mm-hmm. In other words, if n were 1,000 instead of 50, if I went forward 50 generations, things wouldn't have spread out very much. They'd still be in the region where the approximation holds. If you go proportionately the same distance out, so before you went 50 generations, now you went 1,000 generations, it's just as bad, basically. In fact, they approximate each other.
Okay,
so there's a whole thing about how close the true exact distribution is to the diffusion distribution, which has that exact scaling. But I'm not going to get into it. Okay, quantitative characters. Okay, let's imagine individual gene frequencies doing this, and we're going to assume independently. They're not really, really tightly linked. Some might be on the same chromosomes. That's okay. There's enough recombination. They will roughly genetically drift independently. Then we'll say, okay, what about our quantitative characters? Well, naively, the quantitative characters is a sum of contributions from different loci. It's not quite a linear sum because of dominance. So there's a little bit of quadratic stuff in it that depends on all the dominances of the alleles. What we're going to do is wave our hands and say, ignore that. Let's think of it as a linear combination of what the gene frequencies will do. Well, it turns out if you take a Brownian motion and another Brownian motion and you make a linear combination like 0.8 times this plus 0.2 times that, you know, minus 1.6 times another one, and they're all Brownian motions, you get another Brownian motion. So basically, a quantitative character changing according to a Fisherian model, kind of ignoring a little nonlinearity from the dominance, can be considered to be Brownian. And I discovered, to rather my astonishment, although Anthony Edwards would have said the same thing, he never published it. I was, I think, the first to say this in print in 1973 in a paper on trees from quantitative characters. Okay, so let's imagine the quantitative character itself wandering on a scale. But there's mutations as well. Now, when you start putting in mutations, you say, well, it isn't just those two alleles. New alleles come along by mutation. Well, it gets complicated very quickly. And because it gets complicated, I simply want to say, I think you will find if you were to computer simulate it, that too will contribute to the character doing a random walk on the scale. And again, you can wave your hands and say, Brownian motion. It's still very approximate. Now, the catch is that mutation adds variability in, and you have to, in order to get the approximation to work, say that that's the same no matter where you are on the scale. Now, if you think about it, that won't always be the same. There will be limits. There might be a scale that says, genetic variability is readily available if your phenotype is 6.2, but as you get up to 9.8, you're reaching a limit. It's going to be very hard to find mutations that will get you past, or maybe impossible, that will get you past that limit. What that means is this variance that comes in from mutation will start to die away as you get towards the limit, and will start to be biased. The mutation will start to be biased to be away from the limit. So, I mean, the simplest limit would be zero. If something changes till its length is zero, there is no mutation. It's going to make it, make your finger a negative length. Well, that's a bad example. But so I'm going to decree that mutation is going to do something similar, and you're still going to have a Brownian motion when you take mutation into account, which raises the issue. The nice thing is that the reason you want to keep it Brownian motion is that Brownian motion has the wonderful property that the change after a little bit of time is normal, is a normally distributed increment with mean zero and some small variance. If you add up two of those that are independent of each other, it's still normal, but now with the sum of the two variances. And if you add up any number of them, if you go forward 1,000 steps, it's still normal with mean zero and variance proportional with the amount of variance per unit time times the length of time. So the variance is going up linearly, which by the way means, got to be careful about this, the standard deviation is not going up linearly, it's going up as the square root. So if I go for four times as much time, I get four times as much variance, but that only means twice as much standard deviation. So there's a square root. And it's just a consequence of the fact that variances add up, but standard deviations don't. And standard deviations don't because of the effect of subsequent changes in canceling out previous changes. That's just a simple consequence of that. We have seen that when two lineages share a period of common ancestry, the resulting tip species have phenotypes that covary. And the more ancestry they share, the more they covary with each other. And you ran examples of that last time. Okay, so where are we up to now? Yeah, trees. Where I got to, what I've done is not talk yet about selection. I'll just get a little ahead of the story and say that optimum selection is going to come in, and it's going to come in, I think actually what I should do is go ahead to that. They're a little out of order, maybe. Maybe what I will do is talk about that, and when I post the PDFs of this, I'll repost them with things in the right order. Okay, what about selection? Well, you remember the breeder's equation that I gave you earlier, which is that the change of a character is equal to the heritability times the selection differential. If you're doing breeding in a herd, and selection differential is this thing about how far above the population mean were the ones that you're choosing to be parents. Well, Russ Landy, who was shown there when he was at Imperial College London, he's an American who was in Imperial College London then, but has now just moved to a new job in Norway. Russ, in the 1970s, in his thesis work, which was very, very pathbreaking, tremendously important work, he recast this in a terms that's useful for the kind of selection that nature is likely to do. I mean, humans selecting in a herd of cattle will pick the the best paddle they can for the parents of the next generation, and they'll have a distribution of bestness, and they'll chop it somewhere. Okay, that's truncation selection. Nature is more likely to do optimum selection, as we'll see in a moment, where your fitness increases as you get close to an optimum and then falls away on the other side. That's probably, without having data on it, I can say that it's almost certainly the dominant form of selection in nature. Why? You'll never see in nature a form of selection that makes you more fit the bigger the character is, because then the character, well, you might in some fitness-related traits, but for most characters, having your thumb be a certain length might be optimal. Having it be 10 times that length is almost certainly suboptimal. Having it be too short is not functional is not optimal either. Well, it turns out that when you have a mean fitness function that rises and falls, really whatever it does, Russ found that the selection differential can be written as the phenotypic variance of the trait times the slope of the mean fitness against the population, against the mean character value. And when you plug that in up there, here's the heritability, additive variance over total variance. Here's VP, those are going to cancel. So what you get is that the additive genetic variance times this slope thingy is the change in the character. Now, I'll show you a simpler version of it. So you have to note there's the heritability, but it's times not the slope of fitness with respect to the character, but mean fitness with respect to the mean character, which one has to think about. But okay, here is the optimum. Here's optimum fitness. And what we're going to do to make everything work out beautifully algebraically, the most common way people deal with that is to say, let's assume the fitness looks like a normal distribution. It's not a distribution. It's a quantity that goes up to 1 and then down to 0. The area under it isn't 1. It's not a distribution. But it is a Gaussian curve. And then let's take the, quote, standard deviation of that curve. Well, the standard deviation is just a measure of the width of the curve. It's not the standard deviation of any distributed thing. And we're going to say, well, that's a standard deviation. That means we could square it and make a pseudo-variance called V sub S, which is just it's the variance you would have if that were a distribution, but it's not a distribution. Okay. So the fitness curve is going to look like this. It's going to be e to the minus a quadratic, where this V sub S thing comes in as to how quickly the quadratic falls away. Now remember, V sub S, let me ask you, if V sub S is large, what kind of selection is that? Strong or weak?
Weak.
He says weak. Anybody else? He's right.
Weak.
Yeah, it's weak because it says to drop away, you have to get this square thing to be a certain fraction of V sub S. So if V sub S is big, you have to be further away to drop away by the same amount. As V sub S gets small, selection gets very, this thing gets very narrow, selection gets very fierce, it will hardly tolerate any deviation from the optimum. So V sub S it's a selection parameter, but you got to watch out because the bigger numbers are the weaker selection. Well, after you go complete squares and integrate, and I'm going to skip all those steps, what you get is very interesting. It says that if you go forward one generation and then you breed offspring, you'll get a distribution that has a new mean. The old mean was M. And here's the optimum is P. We'll call that, it's not a gene frequency, it's the optimum value of the character. And we're going to say, well, I guess I made it look like a capital P, or it should be a lowercase p. The optimum value is here, The mean might be a little different. The population might not be at the optimum. It might be sitting a little ways away. The change of the character will turn out to be equal to this thing at times. First, let's talk about this. P minus M. What's P minus M? If you're below the optimum, that'll be a positive number. It'll be P minus where you are. So it will be a number that's positive, and it's bigger the further away you are from the optimum. Its magnitude is larger. If you're above the optimum, it's a negative number. If you're far above the optimum, it's a large negative number. And this thing here is the current additive genetic variance over the phenotypic variance. Now, if VS were not there, that would be the heritability, but VS is there. So what the VS is doing is, to the extent that it is weak, that VS is large, it is decreasing that quantity below the heritability. So that quantity is a bit less than the heritability, maybe a lot less, depending if you have weak selection. So it reflects both the strength of selection and the genetic variability. Okay, and what does that mean? Each generation, you move an amount which is a certain fraction of the distance from the optimum to where you are. So if you're 10 grams in weight below the optimum weight, you will move some fraction of that towards the optimum. So you're just jumping a fraction of the way towards the optimum in one generation. Yeah.
So with this kind of selection, you'll approach the optimum.
That's right. Yeah, if you just follow this, you'll say we're going to go 10% of the way to the optimum. And now, of course, P minus M is smaller. They go 10% of that to the optimum, 10% of that, 10% of that, and it'll keep going, and it'll geometrically approach the optimum from one side.
But because you have drift, you might be able to
drift down. Drift makes things okay. Different, as we will see, and we'll see it in our R exercise. It occurs to me, I don't think I've got R on this machine, but maybe we'll. Maybe we do. Who knows? So, all right, that's a single character changing. Now, I have to talk about multiple characters for a moment. And I guess what I'm going to say is. Let me just look ahead for a moment. I have to look back. I'm sorry. Don't look at the screen because it's going to blind you. Well, I thought I had here, and I don't see it. I'm sorry. I must apologize for this. Okay, I'm going to... go to covariation, which is down there, and here we go. I've been back and forth. I'm
probably blinding you. But
okay. Let me do something on the sideboard, because I think it has to be talked about. And I guess I didn't include it in the projections as I was hastily assembling it. If you have mutation bringing variability into a quantitative character, that will, and if you have a bunch of characters, what you will have is that the variance in the trait If I take the genetic variance in a trait, well, let's say the additive genetic variants in the trait to be approximate. In the next generation, that will be the sum of a bunch of terms, two terms, one of which reflects the genetic drift. Now, genetic drift will reduce heterozygosity in a population, and it will reduce additive genetic variants, and it will do it by multiplying this by a multiple 1 minus 1 over twice the, I guess it will be the effective population size. So, ignoring the effective issue, if there's 1,000 individuals, 1/2,000th of the additive genetic variants will go away each generation. I'm asking you to accept that because it would take a little too long to derive it. And then mutation will bring in a mutational variance we'll call B sub M. So one thing you can do is say, well, if it were true that the amount of genetic variation in the population is in a balance between newly introduced variants introduced by mutation and old variants disappearing by genetic drift, you can say, well, what equilibrium will this tend to? And the way you do that is by erasing the prime and solving for V sub A. And what you get is that V sub A is 2 times the effective population size times the mutational variance, which is to say the variance that will be there at any one generation will be essentially the last 2n generations of mutational input. Won't quite be that because the more distant ones won't, some of it will have eroded by genetic drift, but it works out that it is as if there were only exactly 2n generations of input, if the population size remains constant and everything. So let's imagine this model of the additive genetic variance being maintained by mutation. Now you say, okay, that's cute, that's nice, that's fine. Now, what about multiple characters? Well, the thing I'm going to do is wave my hands and say, actually, this works for multiple characters by replacing these Vs by covariance matrices. We not only have additive genetic variants of individual characters, we have additive genetic covariance of characters. If some of the genes that are contributing to my length of my thumb are also contributing to the length of my forefinger. Why? Because they're general size genes, or size of hand genes. That common contribution, the variance due to it, makes for covariance between those characters. So the characters in your body change, in any organism, change in covarying ways. They're not independent because some of the genes are affecting them. There is a common variance, and it's genetic covariance. So there's additive genetic variance, and then with multiple characters, there's additive genetic covariance. Okay. Now, how about the change of the character in a lineage? This is the other thing. If you say, okay, this gives us a rough idea what the additive genetic variance is, or if you make the multivariate version of it, the additive genetic covariances, you'll say, well, we're approximating. It's really true that the additive genetic variance in a population will go up and down as you happen to get more mutations, or you happen to get less, and you happen to have more drift, or you happen to have less affecting those particular loci. But the average level we're approximating as constant. Okay, it won't stay perfectly constant, the one around that value. Now if I say, okay, I'm in a population that has a distribution of the, let's say we're actually, this is the breeding value, the stuff that comes from the alphas. And it has a variance that's the additive genetic variance, and then there's the multiple a character version of that as well. And what if I say to you, okay, let's draw a sample of 2n, of n copies, of n individuals from this distribution and look at their breeding values. Well, if you remember, if you've had some statistics, you might remember that if I take a mean of n things from a distribution that has a certain variance, does anybody remember what the variance of the mean will be? If I have a distribution that has a variance of 6, and I draw 100 draws from it and average them, that will be much closer to the mean, have a smaller variance. But what's the formula for that that
you might remember from a statistics course?
Variance of a mean. Well, it turns out it is 1 over n. So the variance of the breeding value, I'll say breeding value, this stuff, is equal, when you draw the next generation, it's 1 over n. It's big. So if there's 100 copies, it's 1/100. Which, by the way, means, so the, now the variance is, the, if you draw n copies for the next generation, that's what genetic drift is doing. So it reflects how much change there is from one generation to the next. So for the change in the breeding value, the variance of that is this. I mean, if you consider different outcomes, you start from a certain G, and you consider all the possible Gs you could get, they have a variance of that, so the variance of the difference between the new and the old value also has variance of that. So, the change of a quantitative character under genetic drift goes as 1 over n times the additive variance. Now, the additive variance we know is this. If we approximate its dynamics as new mutational variants coming in and old stuff being eroded by genetic drift. So genetic drift is doing two things here. It's eroding the amount of additive variance, and it's also changing the mean of the population. And that actually is okay, because what genetic drift in general does is it makes the genes in an individual population more homogeneous, but it also makes, if you have two different populations, it makes them more different. It converts within species variability, within lineage variability, into between lineage variability. They could be species, they could be populations. This was all worked out by, that part was worked out by Sewell Wright in the 1930s. Or in the 1920s, actually. Anyway, putting all this together, if I take this equilibrium level of additive variance and I plug that formula in, that's equal to 1nth of 2nvm. That's equal to twice vm. So, interesting fact. If you have this model, this sort of idealized, approximate, very approximate model of genetic variability coming in from mutation being eroded by genetic drift, and that's causing the means to wander, the variance with which it changes is twice the mutational variance. Now remember, that's the mutational variance coming in to an average individual. It doesn't depend on the population size. We just canceled the population size out. And you might say, how could you do that? How could that be true? It says that if we have a lineage, and it's a small population, 1,000 individuals, it will wander on the phenotype scale with a certain variance. It'll be doing an approximate Brownian motion. Now we take a big population, 1 million individuals. It will wander through time, also with the Brownian variance. Now you might say, well, any idiot can see that the small population is going to wander a lot more than the big one, right? 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 No. Why? Because the small population will have proportionately less genetic variation in it under this equilibrium with mutation. and it cancels out. So the small population ends up wandering just as much on the axis as the big one does if we approximate by all these hand-waving approximations. Does anybody feel that this is wrong? I mean, that I've given you a plausibility argument with a great deal of hand-waving, but basically what it's going to say is the mutational variance turns out to give you the pattern. So if we have two characters and there's twice as much mutational input into one as the other, twice as much variance coming in, the population will wander twice as much in that direction as it does in that direction. So the wanderings will reflect the mutational input in the end, because that will get inflated into the additive genetic variance. That is what gets sampled by genetic drift. So that's the interesting mathematics. It is a version of Kimura's principle for mutational substitutions at individual loci, which is that the long-term rate of neutral, this is neutral molecular evolution, so far I haven't put selection in. In neutral molecular evolution, the rate of evolution is in the end equal to the mutation rate, the neutral mutation rate, and the population size cancels out, and it's the same cancellation. And it's true, a big population will maintain more neutral variation than a small one, but it will also have less sampling, and they cancel each other out. So this is a version of that. It's a quantitative character version of that. Okay, now, let's ask then what this says. This plus what we know about optimum selection says about the way the means of a lineage changes. Now we're putting all three forces in, putting genetic drift, mutation, and some kind of selection. Be very hand-wavy about that. So if I look at two characters, and I say, how will brain weight and body weight change in a lineage under this stuff plus selection, plus some kind of optimum selection? Well, you can say, you can see immediately that there are going to be genetic covariances between the characters. A gene that increases brain weight may increase body weight also. Some of them will, some of them won't. Some alleles might cause opposite changes. But there will be some covariance, and that's this mutational covariance. And then you can say, oh, okay, if we see a correlation between brain weight and body weight, looking among lineages, that might be, for example, among species, what does it do to? And everybody comes up with the same thing. Everybody says, genetic covariances. Or they say developmental covariance, which is wrong. That's something different, isn't it? Well, not if you really look at it. It's a form of genetic covariance. Developmental covariance just means genetic variations have to work through the developmental system. And if the developmental system forces you to change those two characters in a correlated way, that's how genetic covariance will work out. So this includes developmental covariances. Okay. A lot of people say, okay, if I see brain weight and body weight changing in a correlated way, maybe it means that they have genetic covariance. That down at the mutational level, mutants that increase one tend to increase the other, mutants that decrease one tend to decrease the other. A lot of people will get that, but very few people will see the next point, which is what I call selective covariance. It was named by Olaf Tedin in a paper in German in 1926. Tedin was a Swedish animal breeder who was active from the 20s on into the 50s. And his paper is very obscure, but it does discuss this. And in 1950, G. Ledyard Stebbins, writing Variation and Evolution in Plants, which is his great, it's one of the five semi-popularizations of the modern synthesis in evolution, of the five people who wrote books on that. Stebbins' book was the last, but he writes well. And he pointed out selective covariance, Ted Ng's work in selective covariance. Well, what is selective covariance? Selective covariance is that the selection tends to change two or more traits in a correlated way, even though they may not have genetic covariance. So if the same, let's say the same selective conditions tend to favor a larger brain and a larger body, then even if they have no genetic covariance, they will change in a covarying fashion. And you can actually sort of show this now. Here is a silly example, but an example I like to use. What is this selective covariance? Imagine a phylogeny with lineages, and some of these, most of the lineages are in temperate areas, but two of those lineages have moved into the Arctic. And these are mammals. And let's imagine that in under Arctic conditions, you are selected for larger size, darker coloration to pick up solar radiation, and relatively shorter limb length. Those are well-known rules called Bergman's, Allen's, and Klobler's rule. Now, if you look at them, what you'll see is these things are changing in a correlated fashion. What's causing the correlation is there might be no reason to believe that size would be correlated with color. There may be no genes in common. Relatively short of limb length, well, you could evoke allometry, and you could say, well, maybe. But from this point of view, there will be a covariance, and the covariance will be because of common selective pressures, the co-occurrence of selection pressures, really. And that is an example of selective covariance. Ted Ng called it selective correlation because he's thinking of correlation instead of covariance. It's not substantially different. Okay. And the result is that the outcome of you can work out expressions for the variance of the trait through time, of the trait mean through time. One of the terms you have to put in is the variance of the covariances of the selection the covariances of the selection differentials. You can do it in Landy's form. I'm not going to give you any of those equations, but I'm just going to ask you to accept the idea that covariate correlations of characters through time come from two sources, one of which is genetic covariance, and the other, which is the covariance of the selection pressures. They both come in, you can write a formula that has both of them in it and shows that they both affect the outcome. Okay, now we're going to get, I want to get to phylogeny. Well, I'm going to get to phylogenies because the thing I was about to show you is essentially it's essentially what you will see in your R exercise, in your R running written simulation. Okay, so now let's imagine we have a phylogeny, we have a branching tree of lineages, and they're undergoing these processes. Let's model it by a Brownian motion of characters, but the individual characters are not changing independently by Brownian motion. They covary with each other because they're mutational covariances and because of the covariances of selection pressure. So the genetic covariance and the selective covariance. So brain weight and body weight will undergo a Brownian motion in this model, but they will be correlated with each other. They might be correlated by 0.67 or something like that. For both of those reasons. Okay. Here's a phylogeny. Okay. Now suppose I do Brownian motion. Suppose we want to look into the issue of how much the characters covary in their evolution. We want to see whether brain weight is covarying with Brownian motion. with body weight, I'm sorry, under Brownian motion. Suppose, let me give you an example in which there is not any covariance between those characters. So I just have two independent Brownian motions, one for brain weight and one for body weight. We'll come back to when they really are correlated. And I evolve up that tree I just showed you. And I do so proportion with the variances accumulating proportional to time, which is normal Brownian motion, ordinary Brownian motion. Now, what do you get? Well, there's a run in which I have 22 individuals in each of those two groups I just showed you. And there's 11 in each group, and there's a split here, and some common wandering, and then individual wanderings, basically. Now, if I simulate, I get that, and you might say, okay, is there a covariance there? If I fit a straight line through these and ask if it has a non-zero slope, what do you think will happen? What's your eyeball say to you? They're correlated, right? But I just told you that I generated this without any covariance at all. How could that be? Well, the answer is, if I fill in these points according to which group they came from, remember that the groups were, one was gray and one was black. So we filled them in. There they are. Now look what happened. There are all the individuals in one group. There are all the individuals in another. Now if you look within each group, is there a covariance in this group? Well, maybe it's a little bit negative. Not completely clear. Is there a, if you just looked at this group, is there a covariance? Well, no. What about this? Well, that is the wandering during those two branches. And it happened that this branch wandered up on both characters. This branch maybe wandered down on both characters. And that created the appearance of a significant correlation. What mistake did we make in doing the regression? What is the assumption when you do a regression? What do you assume about where the characters come from? I'm going to tell you the answer rather than torture you. They come from some common distribution, and they're independent, identically distributed. Okay. Now, here's the point. Oops, sorry. In this tree, are those independent, identically distributed tips? And the answer is no, because they have some things in common. This stuff has some things in common, and that stuff has some things in common. And they're not IID. They violate that assumption, so the test is not legitimate. And that's the whole point of a phylogeny. A phylogeny is a diagram of how non-independent they are. If I take two species, closely related species of whale, their characters will be correlated with each other. They're both whales, for example. And compare them to two species of, you know, the sequoia tree and the redwood tree. They're non-randomly covarying in their characters. The whales will show similarity in the characters of their kidney. They will also show similarities in the character of their lung. Why? Because they're whales. And they had a common periods of evolution. So a phylogeny is precisely a diagram of how it isn't independent. Now, under one of these Brownian motion models, I'm going to go 5 more minutes, give you all of the contrast method in 5 minutes. It's going to be a challenge. Here's a diagram. Here's 5 species. Here are branch lengths. Now, what I put on the branch lengths is something that is proportional to, it's like a time, but what it really is it's proportional to the expected amount of variance that will accumulate as you do your Brownian motion in that branch. Okay. Normally, if they just go proportional to time, those would be something proportional to time. But they don't need to be. It could be that one branch has undergone more of this Brownian motion evolution, is expected to undergo more than the other. I wanted to cover that case. If you do that, I'm going to go back for a second. Back. To here. You have a tree, you have these variances accumulating. These two tips will be correlated in one character with each other because of this common period of evolution. And that is expressed by the covariance matrix of the tips. And again, remember the runs you did last time. The more common evolution they have, the more covariant they will be. There is a pattern of covariances here reflecting the pattern of shared evolution. How long? So for example, the first two tips, have a common variance of V8 plus V9 out of their total variance of the one V1 plus V8 plus V9 and the other V2 plus V8 plus V9. Those were here. This plus this is the covariance of those two, is proportional to the covariance of those two. Now I'm going to go zipping back to the... here we are. Yeah, and that will be seen. Here's some simulated evolution on a 5-species tree. It turns out that if I take on one of those trees, I've got this stuff in the wrong order, and I'm going to reorder it before I repost it. I'm sorry. If you're here, I can take, this is something that actually I did in my thesis in 1967. If you take the difference of traits between these two species, it will have a variance which is equal to the sum of 0.3 and 0.1. If you take a weighted average of them, you can do so in a way that is independent, that makes that average independent of the difference. And what is the weighted average? Well, it's to weight inversely proportional to these lengths. So for two tips, we're going to take x1 minus x2, which will be normally distributed with a mean of 0, because we don't know in advance which one is going to wander up and which one is going to wander down, and a variance that is proportional to v1 plus v2, with a constant of proportionality being the rate of movement of our Brownian process. The weighted average, if I take a weighted average that weights each value inversely according to the V of its branch, and that is this, it's the weight times the character plus the weight times the character over the sum of the weights, that is normal with a variance of, I'll say with some bare mean, some mean and some... It will make a fake species, which is really an average of these two species, and it will fit on what I discovered in 1967 is it will fit on this tree as if it were a tip with this much variance plus a little bit. And the plus a little bit turns out to be plus, it's not obvious at all what it's going to be. It's V1 times V2 over V1 plus V2 times the sigma squared thing. So in other words, you can take differences on the tree of adjacent tips and pull them off the tree, leaving behind a weighted average that still makes it a tree, but with one fewer species. And that is, these are contrasts, and I'll just show you one thing, and then we're going to stop and do our exercise. If you pull the contrast off the tree I just showed you, put back here, with all these numbers, they turn out to be XA, now this is the contrast across the tree in one character. We haven't got the covariation of characters. You have one contrast between A and B. It is a variance proportional to 0.3 plus 0.1, 0.4. Leave behind a weighted average, which is weighted three times as much on B as on A. Take the difference of it from C, which is the next neighboring point here, weighted average minus C, and it comes off as a contrast that has a variance proportional to 0.975. Again, going back, you can take a contrast between D and E, and that has variance of 0.2, and then you can take a contrast between the average of the left three species, weighted appropriately, and the average of the right two species, weighted appropriately. The weights coming off by these rules, and you get variance proportional to that. All of these differences have a mean of an expectation of zero. They have variances proportional to those. You can rescale them by dividing by the square roots of those variances, and you then get normally distributed numbers that have an expectation of zero, and they have a common variance. And if you do that to the original simulated data that I showed you, where you had the 11 points and the 11 points, then everything works out much better. Here are the contrasts. Black indicates contrast within the black group. Gray indicates contrast within the gray group. Circle, open circle, is the contrast. There's a single contrast between them. When you plot those out here, there's no correlation, and there wasn't any correlation. So covariances get you independent things off a tree, which whose very raison d'etre is to show you a diagram of how they're covarying. But if you have a Brownian motion process in each character, you have this kind of idealistic scheme of covarying Brownian motion. This thing will get you contrasts in each character, and you plot them, and you find that the covariance of their change will show up in that plot, which can be regarded as IID. You've taken away the non-independence of traits, the non-independence of tips, that was implied by the phylogeny. I've got to the end of a run over, so let's get... Can you pop open your computers and try the R? What I've got in there, I won't do it on the screen because I'm not sure I have R. Oh, what I've got in there is a single routine called Chase... I think it's Chase Mean or something like that. Chase Peak. What is it called? Chase something. And it has several arguments, and there's a space that's from -1 to +1 in each character. There's two characters. It goes from -1 to +1. You put in, first of all, the coordinates you want it to start at. And what it's going to do is it's going to undergo a movement due to genetic drift, where the two characters are assumed to be negatively correlated. They have a -2/3 correlation. And it's then also being attracted to a peak. The peak wanders on the main diagonal. That is, the peak has values of optimum values of x and y that happen to be equal to each other. It wanders up and down the main diagonal. So what you put in is the two trait values, how much time you want it to go in generations, and the variance of the optimum. So you can try a case where the optimum stays at zero, stays in the middle of the plot, see what happens. I'd urge you to try that. And then you can try cases where the optimum wanders more and more up and down the main diagonal. Let's see if you can do that. What you find, the black lines are what the trait is doing. The red dots are where the optimum is going. So first of all, has everybody got it running? four arguments.
Where's the code?
It's the code is there's a link to a at the website to a text file, and you can copy and paste out of that. I tried to find it on the. I put it on our Catalyst account, and then I couldn't find it. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm with you.
Is it there?
Yeah.
It's called JFR Exercise 3. Dot text.
Can you repeat what are the four?
The four parameters are starting x, starting y. Number of generations. So x0, y0, time, and variance of the peak. And the peak is moving. The peak is undergoing its own Brownian motion. It's not obvious that a peak will do Brownian motion, but...
And they're
going to
have any value between...
Well, the variances can't be negative, and the time should not be negative. The time will be an integer like 10 or 100 or 1,000 or interesting values. The variance of the peak, you can try 0, 0.01, 0.02, 0.1, and so on. You'll get a feel rapidly for when it wanders too far and goes off the space.
But x0 and y0 can be?
X0 and y0 can be any spot in the space. Now, if you put them way far outside the space, you will never see them. They'll be plotted out there, and you'll never see them. So it has those four. I was thinking of putting in more parameters, and it would be easy to do that. Let's check and see if everybody's got a run going. You have a run going. You have a run going. You have a run going. Okay. So it's just to get a feel for genetic drifting kind of variance interacting with the... Now, here it's probably zoomed way outside of the area. You can resize that diagram and make it square. And you could also toe the corner. Make it square. And then you could try values that of your peak variance that are small.
Yeah, I think that's the
You could try zero for the peak variance, because then the peak is just sitting in the middle. And you get a good feel for what it does.
How could you interpret the figure? What's the x axis and what's the y axis?
X and y are the two characters, and you could make up any interpretation of what they are.
Yeah, but I mean, we started from 0, 0, 1, 0, by the way, it's different.
You started from 0, 0?
Yeah, x is started from 0, 0, 1, 0, and the y started from 0, 1, 1, 1, 1. But then, way. When you plot
no, don't look at that statement too closely. Let's see, matrix 0, 0, 1, 0, 0, 1, 0? No.
Yeah, I'm just wondering what's the meaning of the x axis and the y axis on the field.
Well, first of all, is that the code? I mean, could you show me the code of the function?
Yeah.
Go ahead, scroll. Where is the 0, 0, 1, 0?
Okay. Oh, I mean, when I pass it, the argument.
Don't pass it a matrix. Just pass it four scalars. Yeah, if you pass it a matrix, I have no idea what it does. Pass it four real numbers, starting x, starting y, time number, time steps, and variance. So I think most people have got it right. Everybody so far? Yeah, everybody has it right. First of all, if you don't have a peak moving at all, what happens? Where does it go?
To the peak and stays there.
I'm sorry?
It goes to the peak and stays there.
It wanders around the peak, but what covariance do you see? Do you see it the two characters covariant? It's not circular, no, it isn't. Look at it.
Oh, no, it's negative.
It's negative. It's negative. I put in a minus 2/3 correlation of the genetic, essentially of the genetic covariation, and therefore of the drift, of the drift part. So the drift part is negative. Now what happens as you put more variance in on the trait? And I'll actually show, I will show you a run that's part of the yeah, here, by the way, is essentially the same thing, slightly different in scale. A negative covariance between the traits causes the genetic drift to be a negative wandering. But if we go long, and this is with a trait value, a phenotype that's wandering on the main diagonal. So it's chosen to be an example where there's a different genetic covariance than there is a selective covariance. The selective covariance will reflect that those positive correlation of the two traits. Natural selection wants them both to be large at the same time or both to be small at the same time. But genetic variation isn't as much available in that direction as it is in the counteracting direction of them being negatively correlated. If you take a short amount of time, you see a negative covariance. But as you go longer and the trait wanders here, I go 10 times as many steps, and it starts not to show, it starts to show, it looks like they're uncorrelated, but if you keep going, they're positively correlated because the optimum ends up dragging them in a correlated way in spite of the resistance of the genetic covariance. And you will see, you should see, if anybody thinks they're seeing anything else, if you think you're not getting this result, let me know and I'll come and persuade you that what you're looking at is really this. So in terms of long-term evolution, it's actually the selective covariance that's winning out as long as there's any variation in the proper direction. It may take it longer to win out if there's very tight negative correlation between those traits. If there's perfect negative correlation between the traits, it won't work. Because that would say that there's you can only vary this way and there just is no genetic variation to go where the peak is going. But in the cases I've given you, there's some. So, yeah.
What are exactly all the number in the metrics for genetic correlation?
For the genetic covariance, there's 1 2/3, and -2/3, and -2/3, and 1. Those are the genetic, those are the covariances of, they're the covariances of the, of the mutational variance, and they're going to be the covariances, they'll be proportional to the covariances of the added genetic variance in the population, and then they're going to be proportional to the covariances of the change due to genetic drift. So I made them that. One could change those and make them parameters and make a bigger list of parameters. It would be very easy to do. Anybody who wants to play around with that is welcome.
And they don't have to be the same.
No, the variances don't have to be the same. The two covariances, the -2/3, do have to be the same because it's a symmetric matrix and there's they're off the off diagonal. So I guess we're out of time, but anybody who wants to ask questions... I wanted to give you this feel for all these forces acting and that there is this way using contrasts of getting independent variants out from a tree. And that's what we'll be talking about. I'm not going to be skimming over things quite as quickly as this time as I did this time. But I don't come back and lecture to you until early November. We've got a big dose of Fred's morphometric machinery But what I'm saying is the morphometric stuff are still quantitative characters, and they're going to follow all these, they're going to follow these processes. And so if this Brown, correlated Brownian motion, covariant Brownian motion, is at all plausible as a model, and it is approximate, then think of it as underlying what the morphology is doing in different species, in different populations, and also in determining the genetic variation within a population. The one thing this doesn't address is developmental changes, because that's doesn't use any of these processes. Okay, so I will release you.